Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the dire results of our culture of celebrity colliding with the culture of scandal, with an exemplar of both, the occupant in the White House, who is a product of a discount version of celebrity culture and is, needless to say, also mired in scandal. Toby Miller, a research professor at the University of California, a professor invitado at the Escuela de Comunicación Social at the Universidad del Norte in Colombia, and professor of journalism, media, and culture studies at Loughborough University in London, joins us. One of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life, we'll discuss the trial in popular opinion underway of the late Michael Jackson following a devastating HBO documentary about the King of Pop's unusual relationships with young boys. We will assess the comparisons to the way the media built up Trump by giving him $6 billion worth of free advertising, but now are tearing down the president they helped elect, to how the pattern of celebrity impunity that O.J. Simpson and Bill Cosby enjoyed was suddenly turned from adoration to vilification as the horrible truths emerged about who these celebrities really are. Will this happen to Donald Trump? Or more to the point, will his followers believe it when the awful truth is revealed to them? Then we'll speak with Nicole Hemmer, a professor at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. She joins us to discuss her article at CNN, Why the Trump-Fox News Relationship Really is Unprecedented, and the revelations in The New Yorker by Jane Mayer of how incestuous the ties between the owner of Fox News and the Trump family are, along with how blurred the lines are between White House policy and the Fox propaganda machine, which both shapes policy and promotes Trump's presidency. Then finally, with the White House trying to limit damage in the Senate ahead of the coming vote of disapproval of Trump's emergency declaration, which the House has already rejected, we will speak with Ira Shapiro, who spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the majority leader and in other senior positions, as well as being the author of The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis, and his latest book, Broken, Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country? We will speculate on what it will take for the Senate to return to regular order and start acting like a separate branch of government from the White House. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Toby Miller, a research professor at the University of California, Riverside, and a professor invitado at the Escuela de Comunicación Social at the Universidad del Norte in Colombia. And he is a professor at the Institute for Media and Creative Industries at Loughborough University in London, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. And his latest book is Greenwashing Culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's great to be back with you.
Well, thank you, Toby. And as a globalized academic, you are also able to comment both on American culture and its impact on the world. I don't know that the HBO documentary on Leaving Neverland was played in the UK, but it certainly created a stir over here. And once again, we are reminded of how the media and celebrity culture builds up these celebrities, makes them immune to criticism in a way. Then the Bill Cosbys and the R. Kellys and now Michael Jackson come crashing down. And of course, prior to that, of course, you had also O.J. Simpson. So how do you proceed with the issue of Michael Jackson in particular, where on the one hand, you should be able to believe the stories of those that have been molested, particularly children. But on the other hand, you have to realize that the accused are innocent until proven guilty.
Well, it's very complicated, obviously, in terms of those who sadly have passed away, as in Jackson's case. They have no opportunity to defend themselves against these current allegations. and nor do the accusers have the opportunity to have their day in court, though, of course, they have been involved in cases against the Jackson estate, one or two of which are ongoing. In terms of the reception here, the documentary hasn't aired yet, but there is massive newspaper and magazine and television and radio coverage of it because of the status of Michael Jackson as a culture hero here. He is just as important in Britain, in Brazil, in Colombia, in Australia, in Hong Kong, as he is in the United States. One of the issues that's being discussed, of course, is that of race and the way in which black men are so often attacked, and especially attacked sexually, in popular culture. The fact that Oprah Winfrey just conducted an interview with two of the men who are testifying in the documentary and done so in her role not only as a black public intellectual but also as a sexual abuse survivor has complicated the story, I think, very considerably. The other factor that's important here, and you mentioned people like R. Kelly in the contemporary moment and O.J. back in the early to mid-1990s, is, of course, that celebrities in general are rather phoenix-like. They can emerge from the ashes, unlike what F. Scott Fitzgerald says. There are second acts in American politics. But if I can stretch these metaphors as far as you can imagine them, like Icarus, they can fly too close to the sun. And then, of course, there comes to be a terrible rendering. So on the one hand, there are massive numbers of fans lined up to defend Michael Jackson's reputation, criticize all his accusers, especially when there's a racial component. On the other, the idea of the talented black man who overreaches in some way and after getting massive recognition is then denounced is also hovering in the wings in terms of a final accounting of his life and career.
Well, of course, Toby Miller, it's hardly, it seems like an awful coincidence that all of the people that we're talking about here who have flown too close to the sun and crashed and burned are all black men, O.J., Cosby, R. Kelly, and Michael Jackson. And that definitely, I suppose, offset by some of the Me Too accusations against Harvey Weinstein, but still, it does seem disproportionate.
Oh, absolutely, and especially when there is a long, long history going back to the days of slavery and the end of the Reconstruction era and the attempt to typify black men as sexually uncontrolled beasts. This is part of the systematic dehumanizing of the African-American male in much of United States culture. There's a great difficulty in navigating the space between what the law rightly says should be the protection of children in this case, the protection of women in the case, it seems, of R. Kelly, and it now appears certainly in the case of Bill Cosby, and it appears the case of O.J.'s instance. And on the other hand, this tendency to corral black men and demean them and hold them to what is, in effect, a different standard. As you rightly say, Ian, Me Too has really shed light on the criminal misconduct of many white men in Hollywood. But by and large, we tend to, even though we have one set of laws that is meant to apply to everybody in the United States, apply them more powerfully against men than against women, and especially apply them more powerfully against African-American and Latino men than we do, particularly to white men, but to a lesser extent, Asian men. And we have to find that complicated line between treating Michael Jackson as an African-American figure and treating him as one more U.S. citizen bound to the Republic laws that bind us together more than anything else.
And again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, who's a research professor at the University of California, Riverside, and a professor invitado at the Escuela de Comunicación Social at the Universidad del Norte in Colombia. And he's a professor at the Institute for Media and Creative Industries at Loughborough University in London. And he's one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and the connection to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. And his latest book is Greenwashing Culture. Well, but the law, for as long as we've had the law, has been subject to purchase. And, you know, even though justice is blind, nevertheless, the rich tend to be able to buy their way out of trouble. And that seems to be a classic case with Michael Jackson and also with O.J. as well. Cosby, of course, had two trials and wasn't successful on the second one. R. Kelly, we don't know about him. But in the case of O.J. and Michael Jackson, how do you separate out the sexual accusations and the accusations of murder in the case of O.J. and the fact that he was a great football player and Michael Jackson was the king of pop?
Well, in the case of Mr. Simpson, of course, the other factor is that some of the police investigating the crime appear to have been racial bigots. We recall the misconduct on their part, both in terms of simple police competence, but also in terms of there being racial prejudice involved.
Toby, there's another side to that, though. The two cops who, along with Furman, who were in charge, who came to the house on the first call, they were completely snowed by O.J.'s celebrity, and they let him go to Chicago for a speaking engagement. And a lot of the prosecutors thought that that was just an absolute gift to O.J. Normally, when you grab somebody closest in time to a crime, that's when you sweat them, you know. But if you give them a couple of days to think about it, that's a bit of a gift.
Well, of course, in counterplay, in juxtaposition to the race question is the celebrity question. And similarly, when it comes to Michael being king of pop and Oprah saying you're not just king of pop, you're almost king, there is a tidal wave of positive feeling that is immensely powerful and is also prejudicial in the other direction. This is not a simple matter. The other question here that I think has to be dealt with is that in a non-monarchical Republican society, and I use Republican obviously with lowercase r, like the United States, you don't have what you have in this country, in Britain, which is, for better or worse, a pathetic, unelected, uneducated, moronic monarchy, onto whom you project ideas about behavior, where you look at, for example, Lady Di and Prince Charles and their marriage and all the scandal that accrued as a consequence and her tragic death. And that becomes in part a way of projecting how you yourself might behave, right? That's a traditional role in constitutional monarchies of the monarchy. They don't do any real work, but they represent a notion of how a family might operate. Well, with celebrities in the United States and in other countries that don't have monarchies, that's what the uber level of a celebrity does. It's a place to project an imagined other way of behaving, whether it's about fun, fast cars, castles, beachside residences, or it's about drugs, decadence, misuse of power, right? Whether it's the sunny, positive side or it's the negative, grotesque side, whether it's being the king of pop or being a child molester, whether it's being an entrepreneur supporting independent filmmaking in the United States or it's being a serial sexual harasser, whether it's being a major hip-hop artist or a serial offender against women's rights. Yeah? And in part, the fascination with the positives and negatives of these celebrities is about projecting the extremities of our own lives, our own fantasies, yes, in the same way as the obsession with the British royal family manages to do.
Well, obviously, the royal family, apart from Prince Philip's driving habits and the fact that Prince Charles apparently was given donations from a shady Russian oligarch to rehabilitate a stately home, the fact that we have a president that comes out of a celebrity culture. We have a reality television president, and that's never happened before. You've never had in the political realm somebody that is so much a creature of celebrity, so much a person who craves celebrity to the point where he pretended to be his own public relations person in order to get better coverage from Forbes magazine so that he would appear on their richest 400 list, which he absolutely almost ruled his life. Still to this day, you know, he's a phony billionaire who craves to be a billionaire. And in fact, we learned from Michael Cohen, ironically, that Trump didn't expect to win and didn't want to win, that he thought running for president was the greatest infomercial in history and it would do wonders for the Trump brand and he could make a fortune losing. Now, of course, he's in the world's greatest goldfish bowl under enormous scrutiny, and his celebrity is wearing off. His reality TV daily stunts are getting tired.
Well, Ian, if you go back 65 years, the famous Hollywood actor and later director, Robert Montgomery, was the first presidential consultant on imagery for television. So he not only coached Dwight D. Eisenhower on television appearances in terms of how he would speak and gesture, but also the clothes he would wear. And we've seen an incredible augmentation of the power of that sort of image manipulation ever since, perhaps most famously the 1960 presidential debates, where it was claimed that Nixon had a 5 o'clock shadow and looked like yesterday's man, and Kennedy looked like today's promising young, dashing cavalier. Now, we know there are lots of other ways of understanding both Nixon and Kennedy than that would allow. And we then get enormously telegenic figures as our presidents. Reagan, who, of course, had been not only a major union official in Hollywood, but also a reasonably successful B-movie actor and then television spokesman for various commercial products. Kennedy himself before that, but obviously Reagan, Clinton, and Obama as conventionally heterosexually attractive men who were, particularly in the case of Clinton and Obama, extremely articulate and media savvy. But they were people who had paid their dues in other industries or in politics. In the case of Trump, he really is the famous for being famous figure. He inherits daddy's money. He gets these rather dubious educational qualifications. He becomes a representative of the class that says they're successful managers, negotiators, and so on. But in fact, they're just very good at promoting themselves in gossip columns, whether it's the New York Post, Forbes magazine, or later on CNN, CNBC, and so forth. The other thing, though, of course, that Trump has managed to do, and which is a core element of turning celebrity status into something more, is that he speaks for a group of people who deem themselves disenfranchised. That's a big difference from what O.J. or Cosby or R. Kelly or Jackson could ever think about doing. You note that however famous they may have been, however noteworthy Bill Cosby might have been in, say, the 1980s and 90s, other than occasional lectures to the black community about responsible parenting, they never really took a political stride. They weren't in a position where they could risk everything the way that Reagan could or Trump can by appealing to a particular supposedly disenfranchised white majority. They could not come out and speak as black men about black disenfranchisement. O.J. extremely apolitical. Michael Jackson the same, although of course there are some bits of his music such as They Don't Care About Us, that obviously have important civil rights overtones. They were not in a position where they could broker that celebrity. Trump does both. He may be out of control. He may be, in many ways, extremely incompetent. But he is a good media manipulator. He's grown up through that world. The question is, now that the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others who gave him appalling free amounts of advertising for his political campaign have turned on him, and he has turned on them, whether or not what amounts to a campaign to diminish Trump, you've only got to open the New York Times any day of the week, and the campaign is continuing, whether that will have an effect is hard to tell. I suspect that 40% of the US electorate will vote for any Republican who's nominated. It doesn't matter what their name is or who they're from, and that of those 40% of people in the United States who will vote Republican, a significant number adore Trump. They love the way that he attacks intellectuals, he attacks science, he attacks liberalism, he attacks a bourgeois media but doesn't speak to them.
Well, just in closing, it seems like that James Carville's adage that politics is show business for ugly people doesn't apply to what you've just told us, Toby Miller, and you're right in pointing out that Trump was given $6 billion at least of free media to get elected, and now it feels like maybe the mainstream media are expiating for what they did. But is that also a part of this pattern of celebrity culture where these icons get built up and then torn down?
Well, on the one hand, there's a Horatio Alger myth that people like, which actually does apply to people like Bill Clinton. It applies to Barack Obama. Horatio Alger myth, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, transcending your circumstances of birth and emerging into the American dream. That is a very powerful mythology, and it will probably never go away. What we need to do in our public culture in the United States is disarticulate the notion of a meritocracy from celebrity. Celebrity is principally an industrial category. It is an object of manipulation, whether it be record companies or Hollywood studios or TV networks, whether it be reality TV producers or whether it be Donald Trump and NBC when it was his boyfriend, the New York Post, any of the other media that he has mutually manipulated. We need to stop thinking of celebrity attention as a sign or a marker of fitness for anything, be that a role model in the case of Michael Jackson, where we began, or be that fitness for public office in the case of Tiberius, currently trading as Donald Trump.
Well, Toby Miller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure, Ian.
And I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who is a research professor at the University of California, Riverside. He's a professor invitado at the Escuela de Comunicación Social at the Universidad del Norte in Colombia. And he's a professor at the Institute for Media and Creative Industries at Loughborough University in London, and one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Greening of the Media and Blow Up the Humanities, and his latest book is Greenwashing Culture. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the Trump-Fox News relationship and the incestuous ties between the owner of Fox News and the Trump family.
Political bedlam. Don't let the hype into your eyes and eardrum. Murdoch on Fox, not 18 with Barackas. And he hate Barack cause he marched with the marches.
I pledge allegiance to the fair and balanced truth. Not the biased truth, not the liar's truth, but the highest truth. I will not be deceived, nor will I believe in the propaganda. I will not.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nicole Hammer, who's a professor at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and a research associate at the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney in Australia. She's the host of the Past Present podcast and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. And she has an article at CNN, Why the Trump-Fox News Relationship Really is Unprecedented. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicole Hammer.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks, Nicole. And it's pretty extraordinary that apparently almost every evening when Sean Hannity gets off the air at 10 p.m. Eastern, he picks up the phone and talks to his pal, Donald Trump, as though the President of the United States has got nothing better to do than get a review of his daily activities, such as they are, largely watching television, I understand, from a television personality. That's pretty extraordinary. I mean, the only analogy I would give you, since we're out here in Hollywood, is that it would be like an actor being more interested in the reviews than the actual performance.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really excellent analogy. And it's something that is part of the fabric of unprecedentedness when it comes to the relationship between Donald Trump and Fox News. It's not that journalists have never advised presidents before, but this kind of coordinated messaging and advice is something that's pretty new. And that it's not just Sean Hannity, but the whole station. I mean, Laura Ingraham talks to the president quite frequently. Bill Shine, the former co-president of Fox News, is on Donald Trump's staff. So I think it's that the expansiveness of Fox News personalities who the president talks to and the frequency with which he talks to them that is honestly kind of shocking.
So what is going on, though, with Rupert Murdoch? I mean, to my mind, Rupert Murdoch is probably, as and historians might well look back on this, as he's probably the most significant figure in the Trump administration, rivaling Trump himself in as much as he is the person that keeps that base at 40% inside that Fox News bubble, where they seem to be impervious to facts and evidence and support Donald Trump in a cult-like way. There's no evidence that that's breaking down. So, in effect, Murdoch keeps Trump in power, you might argue. And yet we're told that he gets off the phone with him, and I believe he talks to him regularly too. He gets off the phone with Trump and says, "What a bloody idiot," you know. So how do you explain that? The power broker on the one hand and his personal recognition that maybe this guy is not up to the job.
Yeah, I think that in many ways Rupert Murdoch is cashing in on 20 years at Fox News, this ability to have developed a base that he has not only a good connection with, but a good read on, right? It's not just that Fox News programming is shaping what Republicans and conservatives who watch believe, but their beliefs are shaping what the channel covers as well. I mean, this is something that Fox saw in 2013 when it started programming in favor of immigration reform and very quickly found out that viewers were not interested in their take on that topic. And so part of it is a kind of the devil's bargain, right? Here he finally has a president who watches Fox News religiously, who has a deep relationship with the channel. And yet at the same time, Donald Trump is not necessarily embracing all of the politics and policies that Rupert Murdoch would like to see, right? Especially on issues of immigration and actually protectionism. I think Rupert Murdoch is more of a Wall Street Journal Republican, to name another news outlet that he owns, than a Fox News Republican. But this is the guy he has, so he's going to do what he can with him.
Well, the relationship is pretty deep on a personal level. I mean, for example, Rupert Murdoch essentially was the matchmaker with Ivanka and Jared. And when they broke up, he then arranged for them to meet on his yacht for the weekend without telling the other that he or she was turning up. And that reignited the romantic flame, and the rest is history. So it's odd, isn't it? I mean, he's been a kingmaker forever with, you know, Tony Blair and others, both on the left and the right. And he decides who becomes prime minister in Australia, since his newspapers, about two-thirds of the media, they dominate Australian media. So he's got a lot of clout. Not that he doesn't have a lot of clout here, but he has more in Australia than he does here. So again, it is a very strange situation. And your book, I think, is really valuable, Nicole Hammer, The Messengers of the Right, a Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics, in going back into the history of how the right harnessed the media to become as powerful and as dominant as they are, particularly in terms of talk radio and cable news. What about the role specifically, though, that Murdoch played during the Reagan administration in getting rid of the Fairness Doctrine? And it coincided with him becoming a U.S. citizen almost overnight.
Right. So the Fairness Doctrine was a piece of broadcast regulation that required outlets, radio outlets and television outlets, to cover issues of public controversy and to cover them in a balanced way. And conservatives were kind of split on whether they liked the Fairness Doctrine or not, but a lot of them saw the Fairness Doctrine as a way of quieting conservative voices, because a lot of times it was used against conservative talkers as being kind of too extreme or requiring news stations to give free time to liberals in order to counterbalance any sort of right-wing talk. And in 1987, the Reagan administration got rid of the Fairness Doctrine, and in 1988, Rush Limbaugh went national and began his ascent not only to sort of media stardom, but to having a real influence on the Republican Party. I've been doing some research on the early 1990s, and in the early 1990s, it's hard to recapture just how much of a phenomenon Rush Limbaugh was, again, not just as somebody who could get millions of listeners and was making money hand over fist, but who was having a real impact on the Republican Party, who in 1994 was named an honorary member of the freshman House for helping lead the Republicans to victory. And so the demise of the Fairness Doctrine, which comes right before that moment, has been seen as the thing that unleashed the power of talk radio and in many ways unleashed the power of conservative media to be this kind of entertainment and political phenomenon that has only empowered Republicans and has only enriched people like Rupert Murdoch.
And again, I'm speaking with Nicole Hemmer, who's a professor at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and a research associate at the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney in Australia. She's the host of the Past Present podcast and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. And she has an article at CNN, Why the Trump-Fox News Relationship Really is Unprecedented. So just to sort of buttress the impact of right-wing media, for example, Nicole, here in Southern California, in the what's called the Inland Empire, Riverside, for example, being at the heart of it, it used to be all of the Inland Empire was very liberal Democrat. And there was a congressman, George Brown, who represented for a long time, an extremely liberal congressman. And then with the advent of Rush Limbaugh, with so many people in the Inland Empire commuting 2+ hours a day to work, the whole politics have changed. And until recently, it was always a very, very secure right-wing bastion. And the congressman, of course, Calvert from Riverside, is a real estate developer and a very, well, I won't characterize him any further, but certainly not a liberal. So that, is there a connection there? In other words, having that powerful soapbox for so long, for so many hours a day. And in fact, recently, Trump praised Rush Limbaugh, saying, you know, he can talk for 3 hours. Well, of course, he doesn't listen. He's deaf from OxyContin. So.
Well, and Trump himself can give Rush a run for his money on the length of speeches there. But I think that it does have an impact. I mean, studies have been done on the relationship between Fox News viewing and Republican voting, but also talk radio listening and Republican voting, particularly around the Rush Limbaugh show. So these are studies that were done in the early 1990s when it comes to talk radio. And what they found was people who listened to more than 10 hours of talk radio a week. And if you think about it, especially with California commutes, that's not that much. That's 1 hour on your way to work. It's 1 hour on your way back. People who listen to more than 10 hours of talk radio a week are 4 times more likely to vote Republican. And that's, you can determine about causation there, but it certainly is the case that people who imbibe large amounts of conservative media, they tend to not only vote conservative, of course, but they tend to vote for more conservative candidate in primaries, and they tend to be more politically active, right? They're the people who come out in primaries. And that has not only reshaped California politics, which was also fed by, you know, it used to be Reagan country. So, of course, there were lots of conservatives in California, especially Southern California in the 1950s and 60s. But this kind of new wave of conservative media brought a lot more people along with it.
Well, along with your article, Nicole, in at CNN, Why the Trump-Fox News Relationship is Really Unprecedented, there's also an extensive article in The New Yorker, The Making of the Fox News White House by Jane Mayer, which you also mention in your article. Some of what is revealed there is extraordinary, that they had the Fox had the Stormy Daniels story, but it was spiked by management And they also worked on Trump's behalf to go after the AT&T Time Warner merger because, as we know, Trump hates CNN. So this is goes beyond political dogma, right? This this is using the White House for business purposes as well to stifle rivals. And my understanding is that Murdoch, now that he's flush with cash from his sale of his entertainment assets to Disney, is now trying to buy up every television station he can find in the swing states so that he'll have an even more pivotal and important role on shaping American politics.
It's not surprising at all. And I think sometimes, especially in the Trump era, we get very focused on the rhetoric and the morality of a lot of things that Donald Trump says and that he does. And sometimes we lose focus of the business motivations of much of what Trump does, as well as much of what Rupert Murdoch does, that the pursuit of power for Rupert Murdoch, as well as for his former partner, Roger Ailes, was about advancing their economic agendas, right? They wanted to be close to political power because being close to political power meant that they could get the best tax rates possible, get the best business deals possible. And so that's part of what we're seeing. And this is something that was very clear behind the scenes at Fox News for well over a decade now. Roger Ailes in particular was quite focused on being a kingmaker. He wanted to make a president. And as we saw in Jane Mayer's excellent article, that's something that Rupert Murdoch wanted as well.
Well, one of the great successes, I think, of right-wing media is the way that they have actually framed this idea that there is a liberal bias and that there is essentially a liberal media. And they tie this in with this notion of elitism, the elite liberal media. And having worked in the media in Europe and in the UK, there's no question in my mind that American media is by and large pretty conservative. And I don't know how they've gotten away with that. What's your explanation?
So a big part of it is that the liberal media argument is one that conservatives have been making for 50 or 60 years, right? So it's not necessarily because it's true, because, of course, there have been, I mean, as you were saying, American media does tend to actually be fairly conservative, depending on what outlets you're looking at, what formats you're looking at, and what topics you're looking at, right? We don't have much of a tradition of particularly left-wing media in the United States. We have some liberal media, but not a ton of left-wing media in the U.S. But over 50 or 60 years, making this argument that media were actually liberally biased, that has sunk in first with the conservative base. I mean, this has become kind of an article of faith of politics for conservatives in the United States. But actually, in making the case that American media were biased toward liberalism, conservatives have more or less won over more people outside of conservatives. The plurality of Americans actually believe that American media are biased toward liberalism, even in an era in which we have a pretty robust conservative media and actually not a particularly strong leftist media in the United States. So I think that part of it is the repetition of the argument. Part of it is the amplification of the argument. And then part of it is that media outlets concerned about their reputations for being nonpartisan or unbiased have bent over backwards to accommodate conservatives and the argument about liberal bias. So they've amplified that argument as well.
Well, as we go into 2020, we know that Fox and the right-wing media will be extremely disciplined and completely on board as the sort of Pravda of the Trump administration. On the other hand, the so-called liberal media, I don't know what role they're going to play, but it's not unlikely that Trump will be reelected and that the Democrats could have a complete train wreck with so many people running for president and reopening the wounds between the Bernie side, the progressive side, and the more corporate side. There may be like a 1968 kind of convention. And this so-called liberal media is, as you point out, not particularly strong. So what explains then why the right has been more successful at media activism than liberals?
Well, I think that part of it is that they have made it so central to what it means to be a conservative in the United States. There's just no parallel to that on the left. There isn't a sustained central critique of media as being biased toward conservatism. You see it here and there. We saw it in like Manufacturing Consent, which was a book that came out probably 35 years ago now, that talked about like corporate media. And there's some of that still in leftist critique of media today, but it's not particularly important to democratic or liberal politics in the United States. And so that has real consequences, because it means when you start up things like Air America, when you start up, you know, liberal cable news outlets, that there's not necessarily a hunger for that kind of ideological media among Democrats. And that's why we see those outlets tend to fail. Now, I think that that could change over time. I think that over the past few years, especially since 2016, that there has been more media criticism coming from liberals and the left. And I would say, you know, there's a bit more of an appetite. We see it fulfilled more by podcasts, I think, than terrestrial radio. But it could change. It just hasn't. We just don't have that tradition on the left.
And we certainly don't have on this particular public radio network, Pacifica, we're teetering on bankruptcy. So the idea that the liberal media is powerful, it's certainly it's not borne out where I sit.
Absolutely. I mean, Pacifica is an excellent example of not just, you know, how often or perhaps how long the tradition of trying to have a more left-leaning perspective on air has been. But, you know, Pacifica, as you no doubt well know, came under fire by the FCC and other regulators in ways that limited its ability to really build a following when it was first starting out. So I think that, you know, there are complicated reasons for these things, but it's definitely the case that there is an asymmetry in America's ideological media.
Well, Nicole Hammer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Nicole Hammer, who's a professor at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and a research associate at the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney. She's the host of Past Present Podcast and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. And she has an article at CNN, Why the Trump-Fox News Relationship Really is Unprecedented. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the White House trying to limit damage in the Senate ahead of the coming vote of disapproval of Trump's emergency declaration. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ira Shapiro, an international lawyer in Washington, D.C., who spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the majority leader and other senior positions, where he played an important role in implementing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Senate Code of Ethics, and the completion of the D.C. Metro Rail System. And his latest book is The Last Great Tenet, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ira Shapiro.
Ian, it's good to be back with you.
Well, thanks, Ira. And the title of your book, of course, is very ironic given the nature of the leadership in the Senate, where much of the criticism of Mitch McConnell has been his craven fealty towards Donald Trump and the executive branch, which is not what the Senate is there for. It's not what the Founding Fathers intended. And there hasn't been the separation of powers necessary. There is now a lot of talk in the media that finally McConnell and the Republicans are actually discovering that they're U.S. senators and what their responsibilities are. Do you think there's a change underway?
Well, Ian, first of all, I have to say, while I appreciated your mentioning my book, I have a more recent book, which was entitled Broken, Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country? So considering that, I think that's very current, because I believe we'll get the answer to that question this year. So I just wanted to mention that because I think it is timely. I think that there are some senators who realize that they're supposed to be senators and not just partisan operatives, that they have an obligation to the country and they have an obligation to under the Constitution. My fear has always been that the weakening Senate, and it has weakened over a long period of time and taken a deep dive in the last 10 years, my fear has been that it would not be strong enough to stand up to a potentially dangerous president if one came along. And one came along. So I'm hopeful that the senators will start remembering that they have some responsibilities to the American people.
Well, so far, of course, the House voted 245 in favor of the rejection of
yes.
Trump's emergency declaration, and that included 13 Republicans.
Yes.
If 10 Republicans vote, and maybe they won't, because if enough of them vote, they only need the 4 or 5, right?
Yeah.
And then they could get cover, because the assumption is that, and McConnell has said this, that they won't be able to override the president's veto. Neither House will necessarily get a two-thirds majority. Would that be the tactic? In other words, even if there are 10 Republicans who could defect, they won't necessarily all do it.
No, I think that the general view seems to be that there will be enough votes in the Senate to disapprove what Trump is doing, that he will then veto the disapproval, and that they won't be able to override the veto. That's possibly true. But I do think, first of all, you take it one step at a time, and the first step is you disapprove what he's doing. The Senate joins the House in emphatically stating, we're against this. If he vetoes it and goes ahead and, you know, then vetoes the disapproval, then they have another decision to make. But in terms of what the American public sees, they see a Congress that at least is pushed back and asserted itself. In terms of what a court might see, the Congress action strengthens the hand of those who are saying that the president's use of the emergency power is improper. So I think it is important that they disapprove it.
And again, I'm speaking with Ira Shapiro, who's an international lawyer in Washington, D.C. He spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the majority leader and in other senior positions where he played important roles. He is the author of The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis, and his latest book is Broken, Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country? So if the...
And the reason it's worth mentioning that, Ian, the Senate's long decline prompted me to write this book, the second book, before I knew Donald Trump was going to be president. I thought Secretary Clinton would win the election, and I didn't think she could govern if the Senate continued to operate the way it had under McConnell. When Trump became president, then it becomes an even more serious thing, because you may not have a strong Senate at the time you need it most. And that's what the challenge here is.
Well, if it goes as you suggested, Ira, where the disapproval, it passes narrowly in the Senate with 4 or 5 Republicans joining. And then
I think it may be more than that, actually. But let's say it's, you know,
right.
Let's say it passes, but it's not, it
right.
doesn't look anything like 2/3.
Right. But the 10 potential votes that Rand Paul is talking about are Cory Gardner, Martha McSally, Joni Ernst, Mitt Romney, Lamar Alexander, Mike Lee, and I guess that's...
Might be Rob Portman. Like that.
Right. Rob Portman. Could they vote in the second time around, do you think, even though it won't be enough? Because my understanding
I think... No. I think that if they vote once against Trump and then he vetoes it, I'm pretty sure they would vote the second time against him, too. Otherwise, right. I think they would look even more spineless than people expect.
Yeah, I just was suspicious that they may not want to vote the first time around and just let enough of them get it over the hump, because they don't want the backlash from the Trumpsters coming after them, the MAGA hat people, which apparently they're afraid of. And that is ultimately Trump's weapon that he wields, it seems, that he's got the base. And as long as Rupert Murdoch and others keep those 40% inside the Fox News bubble, I don't see any change there. And I don't see any chance of overriding a veto in the House, is there? I mean, that would be even a heavier lift, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think the House Republicans are far worse as a group than the Senate Republicans. Even they have not broken with Trump on anything. If you look at the Senate Republicans, you can find moments in the last 2 years, usually in foreign policy, where they've actually broken with Trump. Remember, they passed sanctions legislation 98-2 in 2017, tying his hands on Russian sanctions. So they have had moments where they've broken with Trump, and they ought to act more on their conscience and their constitutional responsibilities, and not simply be afraid of being primaried, so to speak, which is obviously on their minds.
But when they have these rare moments of rediscovering their spines and rediscovering their role as a separate branch of government in terms of checks and balances, you mentioned Russian sanctions. They also unanimously voted to condemn Mohammed bin Salman and point out that he's the likely author of the murder and dismemberment of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But the president, in both occasions, has defied their vote. He's not doing anything. So this is an amazing situation. I've never noticed a situation where a president has been this defiant.
No, I think that's true. I think we're in uncharted waters. I think we have a president who is corrupt and dangerous and potentially authoritarian. I think that we are finding out why the framers of the Constitution wanted to have a Senate. And now the question is, will we have the Senate that we need at the time when we need it most? I have been more optimistic than most people, frankly, in part because I believe and have believed that the Senate Republicans have been waiting for the Mueller report. Their argument would be, look, the process led to the appointment of the best possible special counsel. And we have expressed our view that he should not be fired, his work should not be interfered with, and to our knowledge, it hasn't been. So let's see what he comes up with. I think that's a defensible position. It doesn't excuse everything, but I think that's a defensible position. But at some time in the next several months, we are going to be facing the Mueller report, plus everything that is being brought out subsequently by the House committees and the press. And then we will see what kind of senators we have.
Well, it has been pretty shameful, and you have had a long career there in the Senate. I recall when Senator Kennedy was retiring, or he didn't retire, did he, on second thought. I recall one of the last interviews that Senator Kennedy did where he was asked, what was the biggest changes you noticed over your long tenure in the Senate? And he said, we used to work We don't work anymore. We basically only work on maybe Wednesdays and Thursdays, and we go off to the districts Friday, Saturday, over the weekend, come and stay there Monday, Tuesday, and we're doing fundraising. In other words, what are you saying was that we spend most of our time raising funds, which is what also goes on in the House. So is that would you agree that that is the major change that's taken place, apart from the fact that the senators used to sort of basically have dinners with each other and, you know, hang out with each other, which apparently they don't do as much as they used to?
No, I agree that those are both major changes. But the funny thing about it, the situation is, they actually turn out to be capable of legislating. In the committees, they work together the way they used to work together, not quite as well, but there's more bipartisanship. You see legislation on criminal justice reform, finally on the opioid epidemic. You've even seen the most far-reaching public lands legislation come through. So it goes along, and there's more appropriations bills this year than in many years. So things go along, but then they hit something they can't handle, because the hyper-partisanship won't let them handle. And then there's a spectacle, like the Kavanaugh confirmation fight, you know, which was a disgrace from my standpoint, not just the outcome, but the whole way it was handled. So the frustrating thing, Ian, if you watch it, is you know that many of these senators hate the institution that they're in and the way it's evolved. They know it's what it's supposed to be. They sometimes know how to legislate. And then when the big things come, they haven't measured up. Well, the biggest thing that they could face is coming later this year. The question of whether President Trump should stay in office. They won't face it alone, obviously. They'll face it with the House, and they'll face it with the American public. But that's the biggest thing, and we'll see what they're made of.
So just in closing, that is when John McCain made that plea that we got to return to regular order. Is that what he was saying?
Yes. And they make Senator McCain, late Senator McCain, and many others, they make the plea of regular order, return to regular order constantly. And every couple of years, they start down that road, and they start producing things. And then they hit something, usually a judicial nomination, that knocks them off stride. And they can't get over it. Well, they have to find a way to be senators and not just partisan operatives, particularly when dealing with this president and the threat he poses to our country.
Well, Ira Shapiro, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you always, Ian, for thinking of me.
Oh, a pleasure. And again, I've been speaking with Ira Shapiro, who's an international lawyer in Washington, D.C. He spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the majority leader and in other senior positions. He's the author of The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. And his latest book is Broken, Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.